You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Ian, look at this.
What, it's a police box. What on earth is he doing here? Well, these things are usually on the street. I feel it. I feel it, you feel it?
Faint vibration.
It's alive.
Earth Station Who, a fun mashup celebrating nearly 50 years of the Doctor Who universe. Hold tight. You never know where the TARDIS is going next.
Laugh hard.
Run fast.
Be kind. Doctor, I let you go.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Earth Station Who podcast. That's right, folks. We are finishing up with the classic series in this episode. We are talking all about the Seventh Doctor adventure of survival, where the Master returns, the cheetah people attack, and everyone has yellow eyes. Pretty cool. So it's going to be a great episode to talk about, and we got a great crew to join us. Of course, let me welcome, of course, our regulars, Mr. Mike Gordon.
Howdy.
How are you this week, sir?
I am peachy keen.
Oh, cool. And, you know, it's so good to have you here after the little scare you gave us.
Well, you know, the life is exciting, isn't it?
I know. That's what you get for, you know, wanting
can't let Mary have all the fun and scare us all the time.
That's true. You know, why should she have all the medical issues on this show?
It's not exactly fair.
I know. And speaking of Mary Ogle, Mary Ogle's here.
Hey, everybody. It's great to be here.
It's so nice talking to you in the same time zone now.
Yeah, it's strange. I'm still getting used to it.
It's like, wait, I'm talking to these guys and it's dark out? What's going on? What's going on? This is just strange. This is weird. So, but it's great to have both of you here in good health. So, you know, if you want to hear what happened to Mike, he talks all about it on Earth Station 1. I don't want to rehash here. But Mikey, thank goodness you're with us.
No, I appreciate that. And I want to thank everybody who, you know, all our fans, our supporters, our friends who lent their positive vibes to me while I was in the hospital. I really appreciate it. Really, really appreciate it.
Oh, that's... You people did reach out, and you know, hope you know that you're loved, Mr. Gordon.
Oh,
oh, and of course, we love you folks at home. Please, you know, we want to hear from you. That's how much we love you. Please write us at eswpodcast@gmail.com or call us at 404-963-9057. You know, call us, you know, send wishes for Mike, tell him don't get sick again, you know, stuff like that. You know, do any kind of thing. We definitely love to hear from you.
Don't tell me what to do.
The show is brought to you by the fine folks at the ESO Network Patreon. That's right, folks, we have a Patreon now, and guess what, we have new stuff going live all the time. If you subscribe for as little as $1, that's right, you could be, you know, getting all kinds of neat ESO stuff. There's going to be an ESO newsletter. There's going to be exclusive material put out. The Flopcast even did stuff, you know, and so it's pretty awesome. And to, you know, you even get stuff from the Flopcast. You get stuff from Pro Wrestling Roundtable. You get stuff from the PCC. You get stuff from Earth Station One. There's even transmissions from Atlantis did a review of Black Panther exclusively for the Patreons. That's pretty darn awesome. And we were this last weekend up in South Carolina, and we got to interview two amazing voice actors, and that will be going live very soon on the Patreon. And we did a panel at Toylanta that talked all about Masters of the Universe, and that'll be going on there. And I'm sure some of the stuff of the upcoming Wholanta will be up on the Patreon. So even Earth Station Who will have stuff up there. And that could be all yours if you join in with the Patreon. That's pretty darn awesome, folks. I you know, it's pretty neat to see that, you know, people are signing up and you could be part of the in crowd, as we like to say, the inner circle of Earth Station One or Earth Station Who, or if the Flopcast, you could say I'm up there in the inner circles with Cornflake and with Kevin, you know. You might have to like chickens or something, but that's a whole different story.
Must love chickens.
Exactly. And as you could hear, Felicity, the mayor of Chickentown herself, is here because we are going to all talk now about the wonderful con she went to this last weekend up in Baltimore, Maryland. She went to Regeneration Who. Welcome, Felicity.
Hello. Glad to be back.
It's great to have you so soon back up on the show.
I know it's not usual that I go to two Doctor Who conventions in such a short time period, but Regeneration Who had one important attraction that I could not resist.
Do tell. Tell me all about Regeneration Who. Is this a new con? Is it an older con? I haven't heard of it before.
It wasn't on my radar until this year too, but this was the fourth year that it took place. And it's always been in Maryland, but I think it's moved around a bit, you know, different parts of Baltimore. And this year it was in the Inner Harbor, which was a really nice location, convenient to public transportation, convenient to the BWI airport, which is how I got there. And there were a lot of great restaurants right nearby. So I would say location gets an A+. Unfortunately, they're not staying in the same location next year, but I'm sure that they will also find a good location.
I think I heard they're going to be in Rockville, Maryland next year, which is a suburb of Washington, D.C., actually.
Yeah, I actually know that area reasonably well because I had friends and a college boyfriend who lived in that general area.
Uh-huh, because that's where I grew up, so I know that.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
But we'll talk about that off the air. I know all my friends from high school and everything are going, they're going to talk about that area? Awesome. Not on the air. Tell us about Regeneration Who. So who was the big draw for you and who were the other guests?
Well, Peter Capaldi was announced back in January, and that was the one that definitely sealed the deal for me. And in fact, as they were advertising that this was going to be his first interview after leaving the role of the Doctor.
Wow. And
so, yeah. So I did see, you know, he did just the one panel, 1 hour long interview on Saturday, but that was fantastic. He's as delightful as you would expect. He's really a wonderful guest, was, you know, thoughtful and patient with all the interviewers' questions and all the questions from the audience, especially when kids would ask questions. He takes the role of the Doctor very seriously and knows that it means a lot to people. And so I think, you know, that was worth the price of admission all by itself.
That is awesome. And did you actually get to meet him or did you actually just go for the panel?
I just went for the panel. There were definitely autograph and photo ops throughout the weekend. And I did have friends who went for one or both, a little bit out of my price range. But from what I heard, he was just really nice to everyone, took time to ask people's names and just to talk with them a little bit, whether you were getting a photo or an autograph. So again, you know, nothing but nice things to say about him.
That is awesome. Who else was at the show? Was he the main star?
Michelle Gomez, Missy, was also there. So they were kind of the co-headliners, I would say. They were the ones who drew the biggest crowds. And Michelle Gomez had a one-hour panel right after Peter Capaldi. I didn't stay for that because I had seen her at Gallifrey. And, you know, I always like to give other people the chance to see someone if they haven't seen her. And, you know, the room was definitely packed to capacity for Capaldi and standing room only. So I got out of the way so people could have some Missy fun, and it sounds like she was a great guest as well. And then they actually had Peter Davison and all of the companions from his era, Nyssa, Tegan, Adric, Turlough, and Perry. And Colin Baker was there as well. Now, I actually had an encounter with Colin Baker that was worth mentioning because back in 1996, I went to the convention Visions, which was held in the Chicago area over Thanksgiving weekend. That one lasted till 1998, I think, and then Chicago TARDIS popped up in the same time slot a few years later. But Visions was my first Doctor Who convention, and for some reason, my three friends of mine and I decided to dress up in Renaissance Fair garb and get our photo taken with Colin Baker. And these were the days when you could just, you know, walk up and have, you know, a photo taken for free. And so I had that photo. I actually, one of my friends still had a hard copy of it, so I had her loan it to me so I could make an enlargement. And I took that to him and reminded him of what he had said at the time, which was buxom wenches approaching. And he said, what a charming fellow I was back in those days. But he was quite enchanted with the photo and remarked that I had hardly changed, which was, of course, very nice. And he signed that for me. So that was one of the highlights of the weekend for me as well.
So he was flattering you, in other words. That's awesome.
Definitely. And yeah, so I saw he did a couple of panels. Actually, they were celebrating your most feared story, Trial of a Time Lord, because the Valyard, Michael Jayston, was there as well. And I saw a panel with the two of them and Nicola Bryant, who played Perry, kind of reminiscing about Trial of a Time Lord. Now, granted, Colin and Michael didn't remember all that much of it, but Perry was very good at kind of prompting some memories, and that was a fun discussion. I also got to see Peter Davison with his first three companions talk about their first season on Doctor Who, season 19. That was a little more contentious. I think that, you know, Matthew Waterhouse has kind of built up a reputation for, you know, they all kind of make fun of him and then he kind of punches back. So it was a little bit more argumentative on the stage. But another cool thing I saw was Mark Strickson, who played Turlough, has actually, you know, since being on Doctor Who, he pretty much stopped acting and got into film production. And he has directed a lot of nature films and nature television programs. He actually was responsible for discovering Steve Irwin, the late crocodile hunter.
Oh, wow.
Which I did not know, but he gave a presentation with some stories, harrowing stories of surviving crocodile attacks and showing some footage from some of his films. And that was something unique, you know, to see at a Doctor Who convention. And that was really cool.
That's awesome. And, you know, did they have like, you know, full panels otherwise, other than the celebrities, or did they have a full stack of stuff going into the evening, or was it just?
Yeah, they actually did have, in addition to the main panel room, they had three other rooms, you know, with smaller panels. And I saw just a couple of fan panels, but the ones I saw were very interesting and well moderated. And actually, it's funny because one of the panels was about the hiatus in between Colin Baker's first season and second and last season. And Nicola Bryant actually came into the room. She wasn't on the panel, but she came into the audience and kind of took over a little bit and answered some questions.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, that was a delight. She's a delightful person. I would say both she and Mark Strickson are only gotten better looking with age. They are both very attractive still.
They're a very handsome couple.
Yes.
That's awesome. And, you know, did you get to explore Baltimore at all, or did you just hang out at the con?
Really just the immediate area. I had actually been to Baltimore once before with Kevin, and we had gone to the Gebbies Entertainment Museum, which is at Camden Yards, which is just a fantastic place with all sorts of, you know, a huge comic book collection and all sorts of other pop culture stuff. So, yeah, I might have gone there again if I'd had a little more time, but I flew down on Friday and the con started that afternoon, and then, you know, pretty much wound up Sunday afternoon. I actually stayed through Monday, but I think some things were actually, they had snow right before I came down. So some friends of mine had gone down on Thursday, but found some attractions were not open, even though the snow had kind of come and gone pretty quickly, just as it did up here in Boston, fortunately. But so yeah, I didn't take in any of the sights, but definitely had some good food while I was there.
Well, of course, and especially if you like Italian or seafood, mm-hmm. or ribs. So that's what Baltimore's known for. So very awesome. Well, thank you so much. And, you know, want to plug the podcast while you're here?
Sure. My podcast is The Flopcast. Kevin and Cornflake are the co-hosts, and I make occasional appearances. I'll probably be on there soon to talk a little bit about Regeneration Who. And I do the show notes on the website and run the Twitter feed.
Okay, that's awesome. And did you have pictures up on Facebook that people can check out and everything?
I do have a picture. I'll share a couple of pictures on the Flopcast page as well. I have just a couple on my personal page right now, but I will put some of those on facebook.com/flopcast.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Felicity.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Let's take a quick break and we'll be back in the moment and we're talking all about survival.
Little lass and her name is Mary. I can make no mistakes. She's the girl I'm gonna track. Lots of other fellas try to get her on her back, but I'm figured that'll have to get a birdie. Mary Mac's mother's making Mary Mac marry me.
My mother's making me marry Mary Mac.
Well, I'm gonna marry Mary.
This week on Myopia Defend Your Childhood. Myopia Defend Your Childhood is so named because I believe we are short-sighted on the things we watched as kids. So every week we watch a movie that one of the panelists grew up watching and see if they hold up from comedy to cartoons or to action. And for this season, the last Thursday of each month, we're doing a TV show in our Myopia Mornings segments. We watch Saturday morning cartoons and afternoon classics. So find us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. How will you stand when we put your past on trial? Myopia Defend Your Childhood is a member of the ESO Network and produced by Dude Letter Podcasting.
Hey everyone, welcome back. Now we are here to talk about a very momentous episode in Doctor Who history. It is survival. It is the final of the 26th season of Doctor Who, and it is technically the final story of the original series. So it's interesting that we're finally talking about this one. I would have thought we would have talked about this one quite a while back, but we've just worked our way up to it and, you know, prepped Mike with some more Ace and Doctor stories. So it's pretty cool. We are joined by Matthew Kessel. Welcome, sir.
Thank you for having me again.
It is great to have you, Matthew. You know, you are a huge fan of the Seventh Doctor, so that's why we thought it was appropriate for you to join us for this.
Well, thank you for thinking of me to come on and talk about this story.
Oh, not a problem. So let's jump in. Has anyone not seen this one before? I think, Mike, this might have been your first.
This is my first time, yeah.
What about Mary and Matthew?
I have seen it before, but a long, long time ago.
Yeah,
so it was nice to refresh.
I've seen it before. I actually pre-ordered the DVD, which I think came out in August of 2007, but it had probably been 7 or 8 years since the last time I had watched it.
Wow, okay. So, yeah, it's probably been 20 years since I've seen this one. So it's, you know, I watched it when it first, you know, first aired, when we got a copy of it in the States. And for some reason, I just didn't watch this one again. And it's actually a lot better than I remember it being. And, you know, it's not the best, and it's definitely not the worst. I know it's not Ghost Light for Mike's purposes. And
and it's not Time Lash.
And it's definitely not Time Lash. So we got the pluses with that already going. It actually, to me, it feels like almost like a trilogy of Ace's backstory, because now we're going back to her hometown and seeing, you know, that she, you know, who her friends were and, you know, how she was reported missing and such.
Right.
Oddly enough, I've never seen her first appearance on Doctor Who. So
you have.
Have I?
You saw Dragonfire.
Oh, that's right. That's right. We have seen Dragonfire. That's right. Okay, right.
Because she was already on the space station.
She was. And so, but for some reason, I keep thinking that there must have been a time where she was, at, you know, from her hometown and the doctor came to investigate something. And, you know, as it is, she just became a companion after that. But no. Is this the first time we visit her hometown?
That is correct. And as Sophie Aldred talks about in the extras on the DVD, that in a way it would have been good if this had been her first story, because it deals so much with her background and who the character is. But because of the way they decided to introduce Ace at the end of season 24 in Dragonfire, and because, frankly, they didn't know who the new companion was going to be, they literally just plopped her character down in the middle of the events of Dragonfire and then began seeding how she had gotten there in subsequent stories leading up to this, especially in Fenric, which precedes this in broadcast order.
Gotcha. And I do notice, you know, I mean, as much as I, am against Ghostlight, I mean, Ghostlight is a pretty big Ace episode as well. So I kind of appreciate, though, like learning about the companion more and more as it goes on. I think that's a very interesting way to do it, although it sounds like they came across that. They had to do that sort of by accident and on the fly rather than a planned arc for her.
Nope, very true. And it was interesting because I watched the extras on the DVD also, and Andrew was talking about how with this, they were starting to wrap up the character of Ace, and they had planned if there was another season that she would probably only been in the first or second storyline, and then she would have been written out.
Right. And it would have. Right. She would have been replaced by the character we've come to know as Rain Creevy in the Big Finish Lost Story audios. So it was kind of, this was meant to be kind of Ace's last hurrah in a way. And of course, they still thought that there was going to be a season 27 to write her out in.
Exactly. So it was interesting to see, and, you know, talking to Andrew personally and hearing interview after interview after interview, you know, he was saying that they were planning on her going to the Time Lord Academy and, you know, eventually, you know, that was the doctor was training her to be a Time Lord.
I was going to say, because it seemed like, I mean, from what I gather, I mean, it seemed like, you know, she was pretty well regarded as a companion. I'm surprised that this early they were thinking of removing her.
Well, at this point, she had been, what, Matthew, correct me if I'm wrong, almost, what, a season and a half?
Two full seasons plus Dragonfire, so.
Yeah, so... So, you know, that's a long time for old series companions, Mike.
That's true. That's a long time for new series companions.
Yeah, for any companion.
Right.
And Ace was popular. True. She was popular.
Yes, she was.
But they didn't know this was going to be the final episode either at the time when they were filming it. But, you know, that's why Andrew and them had written that last scene in just in case.
Right.
So, right.
Well, they had a... They got the news, but after it was filmed, but before it aired. So then they made that kind of voiceover.
Right. Which
that Andrew wrote.
Right. Which Sylvester ends up recording on the set of Ghostlight, actually, because Ghostlight actually was the last produced story of the classic series.
Mm-hmm. See, Mike, it has meaning for the series.
See, Mike.
Well, you know. I will say that I was surprised. I did not know that the master was going to be in this. So when he popped up, I was very pleasantly surprised. I know that when we've done our sort of, you know, rankings of actors who play the master and everything, you know, Ainley comes up short a little bit sometimes, but I dig him and I think he was great in this.
Yeah, I think it's his best performance as the master, actually.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, he's not my favorite master either, to be honest, but he's really good in this. He has this kind of understated evil menace thing going on, and it's also nice to kind of see him struggling against the influence of the planet because he's actually changing also, which is something you don't, you know, he's not just above it all. He's actually really a part of the story.
Yeah, right. Usually with the master's plot, sometimes they're just so ridiculous that you just shake your head like, what is going on? But there's an underlying menace to him in this that I haven't seen before. And even though the plot, again, with him doesn't make any sense, you kind of feel like you're not supposed to get it. Like there's something happening here that's so downright like evil that, you know, you can't fully understand what he's doing.
Well, you don't even really know what his plan is. Did he get stranded on that planet? Was his TARDIS there and it just broke down? Because if you remember at the end of the third episode, he was trying to break into the doctor's TARDIS.
And, that's right.
And
right.
Using a pocket knife to jimmy the door. It was just like, that's what you do in, you know, most of the things. But it was just, you know, you didn't know what his plan was. It wasn't, you know, I'm going to create an army of cat people to take over the world, doctor, you know, like he does in other stories.
Right.
You just don't know what his thing is. And
well, I got the sense that he was trapped on this planet, but he was using the cheetah people to send a message to the doctor, to get the doctor's attention, because he knew if he focused these cheetah people at Earth and started, like, you know, them hunting Earth, you know, humans and bringing them there, that would get the doctor's attention. So once the doctor got there, he was like, yeah, now this is going to be awesome. I can defeat the doctor and get his TARDIS and go and rule the galaxy. Ha ha ha.
Right. And it's worth remembering as well that per John Nathan Turner's memoirs that he wrote originally for Doctor Who magazine and eventually recorded as an audiobook for Big Finish, when Runima Rowe first submitted the storyline for this, and maybe even the first draft of the script, the Master was not even in it and ended up being in the story at his insistence. I think simply because he realized that they hadn't had a story with the Master and Sylvester's Doctor yet.
No, 3 years since Anley had played the Doctor before that.
Right.
Yeah, I thought it was weird when Ace was like, "Who's the Master?" Like I don't, who's this Joker? Like,
yeah, exactly. Like,
she is not impressed.
Well, exactly, because I think what was it, the first Ronnie story, his last appearance
before this? He was in Mysterious Planet. Good grief, what's the last Ultimate Foe?
Yeah, Trial of the Time Lord.
Yeah,
he was an
Ultimate Foe. And then sort of gets trapped in the Matrix at the end of that. And how he gets out is anybody's guess.
The same way, how did he get off that planet? And, you know, the story was interesting with, you know, the characters, and the sergeant, you know, was just okay. The storyline itself, you know, how the people, you know, who go to the planet somehow start turning into the leopard people. Or either that or they become food. You know, they didn't really explain any of that.
Mm. Well, I think the point of it is that it's just an exploration of what does it mean to be predator and prey, and how humans can be both, and how the morality of it kind of depends on your point of view, you know, whether you're the hunter or the hunted, because... you know, can you say that it's immoral if, you know, when the cheetah people are hunting for food, because that's what they have to do in order to survive? So I thought that was an interesting moral question.
Yeah, very much so.
You know, Rona Munroe does a good job of exploring that. I think she's kind of let down by things like, you know, the costumes. She said in an interview that is not how she envisioned the cheetah people at all. They were supposed to be much more minimalistic, with just kind of glowing eyes and maybe a little makeup, you know, for spots.
Right. They were supposed to be something more akin to Mags's werewolf in Greatest Show in the Galaxy. And maybe it's because they had already done that sort of thing that they felt, no, we've got to do something else. And it's something that does not do the story any favors. It's very much in my mind along the lines of Invasion of the Dinosaurs from the Pertwee era, where what people remember isn't the fact that there was a decent story there. What they remember is the fact that there was rubbish dinosaurs, and in this case, rubbish cheetah people.
No, I could totally understand. I thought the costumes of the cheetah people were beautiful, truthfully.
Actually, you know what? I thought the cheetah people looked really cool. You know, the fact that they were on horseback, you know, had this sort of like Planet of the Apes feel vibe
exactly.
to it.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah, that's true.
I really dug that. Go ahead.
See, I think the problem with the costumes is not that the costumes were badly done, because I think they were actually pretty well done for the time period.
Yeah.
But that they hid the faces so much.
Yeah.
That it was hard to see the actors' expressions. And that's also what Rona Munroe, the writer, said. You know, she had seen the actors doing it without the costumes, and she loved all how expressive they were, and it just all got lost.
I think
when you put the masks on.
Certainly, you know, if they had had the capability then to do the makeup like we see, you know, like we just saw with the new Earth stuff, right, with the cat people there, you know, you get a lot more expression, and certainly it would have made the arc between Ace and Sheila, right?
Kara.
Oh, Kara. Sorry, Kara. Sorry, that's the one. much more, maybe even more intimate in some ways.
Yeah, I think that Rona Monroe said it said in I think that same interview that Mary was quoting, that there was a whole lesbian subtext that was written in for the Kara and Ace relationship that gets completely lost because you stuck Kara in a cat suit, basically.
Right.
Well, it's true. And you know how intricate those costumes were? It was just amazing. What was it, about 2 years ago at Hulanta, somebody actually came dressed as one of them.
Oh.
And it was beautiful. It was truly, it almost felt like it was right out of the show.
Mm.
And they even had the glowing eyes. It was like pretty darn awesome.
Oh, that's awesome.
Oh, that's impressive.
Yeah. So it's like, and Atlanta in June or May is not the coolest time of the year, folks. So that person, you know, almost as bad as the people who were filming this in the middle of summertime in a quarry of all things.
Right, 800 degree heat.
Yeah. I heard it was very uncomfortable.
Indeed.
So, you know, and it was neat to see, you know, the only thing, they had wolf noises instead of cat noises.
Yeah, that was kind of weird. They did.
Yeah.
I was like, during it was just like, what? I did. One thing I did appreciate about it, I'm glad they hid what the cat people looked like until Ace saw them. The first couple times they had the cat people attack the humans, you didn't get to see what they were. You saw from the expression of the person. You saw it from the cat person's perspective.
Right.
And I thought that was really well done.
Yeah, it's a very effective technique. You know, it's when, you know, when Classic Who does monsters well is when it does that sort of thing. You think about the way the Silurians were introduced in that first Silurian story, for example, is very much the same thing. Everything's from sort of the monster's point of view.
Yeah, exactly.
So. Right, and I think that was also effective because it makes the monsters more sympathetic.
Right.
I mean, it's you know, I don't think the cheetah people are, well, first of all, the whole calling them the cheetah people was also unfortunate because it just made it sound kind of silly. When really they're very sympathetic characters, and especially Kara and the relationship that develops between Ace and Kara is actually quite interesting and even has some growth there as they both become more compassionate and move away from violence. But that gets kind of lost in the whole cheetah people thing.
Yes, but remember the cheetah people were controlled by the master's catnip toys.
Yeah. One of my favorite scenes is when, you know, the cat, he throws that at the sergeant and they're all sort of playing with him, right? They're sort of playing with their food. They're sort of batting him around and everything like cats would. And the minute the doctor saves the guy, the cats all turn on the master. They all, like, just turn on him like, hey, our toy and our food's gone. Now what are you going to do? And they just sort of turn on him. He's like, I control you. I control you. And I'm like, yeah, you don't. Like, that's not how cats work. I know that for a fact.
And it's great because the doctor was trying to juggle the catnip toys. And, you know, the cats were not amused. Like typical cats.
Yeah, he might have just got out of the spoons.
Proof that a cat is a cat, no matter the size.
Exactly. I love that. I thought some of the other characters were cool. I mean, obviously they all fit, you know, what they're trying to do in the story. They're more like, sort of representations of things than rather characters. But except Midge. Midge is just an absolute tosser. Is awful. And I didn't want more Midge, but we got more Midge.
Yeah.
No, more Midge that you wanted.
Yeah. We got way more Midge than I wanted. We got, Tom Cruise Midge at the end. So it was kind of sort of like,
but I like that you got Vintage Master by hypnotizing the whole fitness class.
Oh, yes.
And that was awesome. And you know how weak willed Midge was, and the master was able to control him. It was just awesome. And then he willed Midge to die, basically.
Right.
The only thing that was missing was that, you know, he didn't, like, you know, shrink him down to a little midge action figure.
I was waiting for that. I was so was waiting for that.
A little midge doll.
It could have been a midge urge doll. No.
No, mini midge.
Mini midge. We will call him mini midge. But it was, yeah, but it was interesting. The Sarge I could have lived without, truthfully.
Yeah, he's kind of a caricature. I mean, he basically just represents the black and white point of view that the only way to survive is to be the predator. And then the Doctor and Ace come along and they represent strength tempered with wisdom and compassion. And they prove that creative thinking is more helpful than the sergeant's one track mind. But he's not so much a character as just kind of a representation of an idea.
Right.
Yeah. Plus he does provide some comedic relief. I mean, I think the actor was pretty good with the timing and everything. So I did think that at least he served his purpose, you know?
Oh yeah.
Whereas some of, you know, others of Ace's friends, well, the one that she meets outside the store in the first episode, I mean, she's like a zombie.
She just looks stoned.
Yeah, she just looks completely stoned and out of it. And it's like, whoa, this is okay. Like, I couldn't recall ever seeing someone that stoned on Doctor Who before.
It was like, great. And I loved it, the scene when they went to the clubhouse or whatever it was, the activity center. Oh, this is where we had our coffee bar. And it was all graffitied and everything and boarded up and everything. There was no coffee bar there. Come on. But it was interesting because in the extras, when they went to the pub to see if her friends were there, and, you know, she was like going, the scene they had to cut was Ace had said in the scene to the doctor, oh, this is where we used to have guys try to, we gave them money and they would buy us alcohol. And and she says, I'm almost of age now, doctor, so I can go in. And so they had to cut that because Andrew realized, you know, that might not be a good thing for a kid's show. So it's just, it was kind of funny to hear. And
that's what I love about Ace's character. Ace is my favorite companion of the classic series.
She's one of mine, too.
Because she's, I mean, she's not, Ace is not black and white. She's not a goody-goody. I mean, she actually has kind of she can be amoral at time and have kind of a penchant for destruction.
Oh, but she was also a bad girl. She was not a good girl, because even when they went up to the hilltop, she used to say, oh, we used to light bonfires and burn things up here. It was just like, oh. And then the doctor was like, and there were horses up here. There's no horses in town, doc. And they cut right from her being the bad girl talking about what it was to something else. What did you guys think of Sylvester as the doctor in this?
He's awesome. I mean, I mean, anything that I've ever had as an issue with this era, I certainly have not had with Sylvester McCoy. I mean, he's great. And furthermore, he's great. You know, I think he and Ainley had some chemistry together. I would have loved to have seen the two of them pair off, and it would have really meant something. And when the two of them finally do like battle at the end, the only thing that was missing for me was just some more experience between the two of them to finally get to that level where they're actually hands-on battling each other.
Yeah, I think McCoy and Ainley played very well off each other, as you were saying. I think Ainley has more chemistry with Sylvester's doctor than he has with either Davison's or Colin Baker's, for that matter.
Oh, God, yeah.
Oh, definitely.
I couldn't agree more than that.
And, you know, Sylvester, you know, they kept trying, you know, they were trying to find a balancing act for him between sort of the light clownishness of season 24 and sort of the more darker direction he was wanting to go. And I think in this, you know, this final story, they figured it out almost perfectly because, you know, he gets to do some slightly more comedic stuff, the stuff with you trying to run the cat and the dog off in the first episode, for example, or juggling the catnip toys, as you were saying. But he gets to play sort of the darker and the more powerful as well. And he excels across the board at it.
Yeah, there's this almost this element to him that you almost think he wants Ace to become part of the like this tribe. Like he wants Ace to experience this, but then he sort of pulls back as well. It's this weird kind of dichotomy there.
Well, we saw something similar with that in the story with the sea vampires
Yeah, Curse of Fenric.
Exactly. Something very similar, because the Doctor was very dark in that one.
Mm.
And when we watched it, we all thought, there's just something, you know, very sinister about this Doctor. And, you know, you saw bits and pieces of that now in this one, too. Except for when he was trying to figure out, what kind of cat food will my cat like?
Yes.
Yeah.
And he walks out with a handful, and the guy walks after him. Are you forgetting something? And he, like, you know, and he's like, pay? What's paying? You know, that's just the Doctor. So it was interesting. And I was it was a good watch. It didn't drag at all. There wasn't.
No.
And I'm glad
they actually didn't.
I'm glad they did three episodes, because if they would have had a fourth, I think it would have been too much.
Yeah. Then they would have just put in filler, I think, if there was a fourth. Yeah.
If that filler was more of McCoy and Ainley, I would have loved that. But if it did otherwise, yes, I probably would.
You might have ended up with a four-episode story where episode three is nothing but wheel spinning, which happens happens even with four-parters in this era, even. Yeah,
my luck, it would have been all about Midge.
The Midge.
And I, you know, I also understand that the British comedians Hale and Pace are in this as well. Unfortunately, that meant very little to me. I don't know them very much. I'm not familiar with them as comedians. Apparently, they were a big deal at the time. That one got past me when I was looking at that too. Are you guys, any of you guys familiar with them?
Only from this and the fact that they had done the thing that had made them big was a sketch about a microwaved cat, which makes their appearance here all the more ironic.
Okay.
Well, that is literally the extent of what I know.
It was interesting though, because, you know, in the extras, they said, oh, in the inclusion of these comedians. And it's like, I didn't even really find them that funny.
No, that was stunt casting.
Of course it was.
I hate it, actually, when they do that, because it just kind of gets in the way of the story. It wasn't as bad here as it could have been, as it has been in some stories, but.
Right. I mean, it's not Delta and the Bannerman level of where stunt casting just overwhelms the story completely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, exactly. So it was interesting. And here's a question for you guys. The ending, when the Master and the Doctor were having their fight on the other planet, and did the Doctor just, since he was being affected with the cat planet thing, did he teleport himself because it was so emotional, or what happened there?
That's always been my feeling. The handful of times I've watched the story, that's always the assumption I come to, and the Master ends up just kind of remaining there. Of course, eventually, of course, we know he gets off the planet somehow. But that's always been sort of my pet theory with it. The funny thing is that if you watch the story, that last episode specifically with the info text, they go into an entire alternate ending that was written but never shot, which ties into the idea of McCoy's Doctor being far more than just another Time Lord, with both him and the Master coming back there, and the Master having the realization that the Doctor's, you know, far more than just another Time Lord, and the two just kind of part ways at that point. So maybe it's not a bad thing they went with the ending they did.
Well, yeah, because they had hinted and, you know, talked about that the Doctor at this in this period, that possibly he was Rassilon.
Yeah. Well, the other.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or, yeah.
The other.
I mean, they explore that a lot, actually, in the books that come after this and between this and New Who. But
right.
I'm not sure it works. I mean, I think it's actually better if the Doctor is
the Doctor.
Just the Doctor, rather than trying to make him some sort of, you know, god or something, which I think
it would have been a little too much.
Yeah.
Yeah. It seems to be, having read quite a few of the New Adventures where that is a big thing, it does seem to be very hit and miss. It seems to depend on which writer's actually tackling it, because, you know, obviously some writers are going to handle it better than others. And Mark Platt, especially in Lungbarrow, which is the last of the Seventh Doctor books in the New Adventure range, I think handles it, the whole idea, rather well, though it is kind of one of those things you kind of, if you can even buy the book, because the thing goes for a small fortune, but you kind of sit back at the end of it and go, I'm not sure I got all that. On the topic of the books, I mean, they have a lot of fun in the books trying to, you know, figure out the master recovering from the cheetah virus, I think is what they end up terming it. And there ends up becoming, depending on which company, whether it's Virgin or the BBC, and eventually even Big Finish, putting stuff out and trying to figure out how exactly the master ends up overcoming it.
Because, yeah, because if you go, if you don't read the books and you just go by the TV series and such, the next thing with the master is the Doctor Who movie.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Which I kept thinking of watching this again, because between the eye effects, but also I don't know if anybody noticed the belt buckle on Alien's costume is a snake.
Ah, interesting. No,
I didn't notice that.
Look at that foreshadowing.
And also, if you also remember how the eyes at the very beginning of the TV movie were kind of yellowish and more certain like.
Yeah, right.
So that's where I thought, you know, how they tied it in.
Yeah, so. I didn't think of Tom Cruise when Midge walked in at the end. I kept thinking Eric Roberts' master in the whole trying to look.
Yeah, I could see that as well.
Mm-hmm. So it could be interesting to see. So any last thoughts before we go ahead and rate this one?
The guitar screeching soundtrack.
Oh. And the really bad violin.
I actually like the score to this, I have to say.
When it first started, I wasn't sure about it because it didn't fit as well with the Earth stuff. But once they transport to the planet, I thought it really fit really well. It was it added to the atmosphere there. But I wasn't sold on it with the initial Earth bits.
Yeah, I wonder if Dominic Glenn was trying to pastiche the Eric Clapton, Michael Kamen score for Edge of Darkness, the great BBC thriller series that aired just a few years before this, which has a lot of that same sort of mournful sounded screeching guitar.
Mm.
So that's what it made me think of watching it this time around anyway.
It was actually kind of a nice surprise for me, because usually during this era, it's a lot of more synth, heavy synth stuff.
Yeah.
And almost like 8-bit stuff almost at times. So it was a nice actually change for me. I thought I liked it, especially when we got, like I said, when we got to the planet stuff, I thought it added to that very well.
Hmm.
Exactly. So it's pretty interesting with the sound. You know, for me, it didn't do much for me because it was just like, oh, it's such of that era. And
yeah,
it was just like, yeah, that's why I got into grunge.
Yeah, it was just very, very 80s.
Oh, yeah. A lot about this is very 80s.
Right.
When she goes home, it's like, whoa, yeah, this is, you know, from the first guy washing the car, you're like, yep, I know what decade we're in.
With the turned up collar and everything? What gave it away?
Turned up collar and the washed out dad jeans and all that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could tell that about a zillion miles away. Ay. All right, let's go ahead and rate this 1 out of 5 TARDISes, 1 being the worst. 5 being the best. Matthew, you're our guest. You get to go first.
I think I'm going to give it a 4, though if you had asked me before sitting down and watching it today, I probably would have given it a 3. I have to say that, a la mentioning Invasion of the Dinosaurs earlier, this is a story that actually improved in my sort of standing of it with the most recent viewing. There's a lot more to it than I initially saw the first couple of times I watched it, you know, a decade or so ago. The themes in it are quite interesting. The whole thing about, as Mary was talking about, the sort of morality of it and predator and prey. Also, the extent that it deals with sort of Darwinism, both biological and social especially, was interesting. And, of course, we've talked about Sylvester, how good Sylvester is in it, as well as Ainley's master, for that matter. I think it's, you know, and this is sort of looking back on it, I think, with some hindsight, but there is an interesting sense for me of finality to it, especially in that last confrontation between the Doctor and the Master, you know, well before you even go to them literally walking off into the proverbial sunset. It's an interesting story to end the series on. Of course, they didn't know it was going to end it on, but I think, you know, if you were going to end Doctor Who on screen effectively for the better part of 15 years, you could have done a lot worse than this story.
Okay. That totally makes sense.
Yes, you could have ended it with Ghost Light.
I knew you were going to say that. I knew it.
I'm sorry. I couldn't resist getting the shot in. I just couldn't.
I wish I had been on the Ghost Light episode because I would have been happy to have debated you about that one.
Well, you have to have a special debate episode one of these days.
Yeah, we might have to come back to that one because we did it on actually when we were doing Earth Station 1 and Doctor Who stuff. So, Matthew, actually...
So, Mike, you can watch it again.
Exactly. Yeah, well, the thing, sure. Matthew, the problem was that was Mike's first intro to Sylvester.
Oh.
Yes, exactly.
That would make a difference, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, so. I started with Remembrance myself, so I can see, yeah, because that is a story that requires sitting down and giving it some thought, and also if it's your introduction to Sylvester, God help you. At least it's not Time in the Ronnie, I suppose, or Delta in the Bannerman, for that matter, but I digress.
Boy, okay, Mike, go ahead.
Oh, man, see, this is tough. I was... You know what? I'm leaning towards a 4, and I'm going to give it a 4. And it sounds weird because I think I gave Robots of Death a 4, and this is like really, like, obviously Robots of Death, which we just did a couple weeks ago, is more of a favorite of mine than this one is. But there's a lot, as Matthew pointed out, there's a lot to like about this. I mean, the plot's pretty decent. Ainley is great as the Master. We didn't really talk about it, but Sophie is really, really good as Ace in this. I mean, she gets a lot to do. She's not just window dressing, for lack of a better word. You know, we've had issues with other companions before in stories, and this is really all about her, really, you know, her coming home and then her dealing with this being infected with this this hunger. These and this power, and it's just I really like that element of it as well. I didn't mind the effects, you know, as far as monsters goes. I've certainly seen worse. I thought the cat people look great. I think this is a strong entry, and the fact that it is the last of the classic era, I think makes it a deserving of a look-see. So I'm going to give this a 4 as well.
Okay, Mary.
You know, it's. It's very interesting. Like Matthew said, I like this episode a lot more than I thought I was going to. You know, my sort of hazy memories of it from a very long time ago were not that great. And part of it is I've come to appreciate Sylvester's Doctor a lot more than I used to. But also, I think what I really like about this episode is that it's like Mike was saying, it's so Ace-centric. I mean, this is a great episode for Ace. And I also really appreciate the connection between Kara and Ace. And I think it fits Ace's character because I think Kara recognizes a kindred spirit in Ace before Ace even changes, because Ace is such a multifaceted character with... you know, with good and bad and everything in between. And it just makes her such a rich companion. I wish we could have had even more of her in some better stories. So, you know, I think I'm going to give this one a 3.75 because it's not, you know, there are a few problems with it. But overall, I think it's very enjoyable and not a bad episode to necessarily to end the series on. And it does leave you wanting more.
Okay. I do agree with that. Because, you know, let's go to the next season. Let's go. Let's see what the Doctor's going to do. And I would have loved to see more Sylvester as the Doctor. And, God, Sylvester's demise in the movie after this. You know, hey, I'm the Doctor.
You know? Yeah, spoilers.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, yeah. All right. For me, you know, I'm going to give it a 3.5. I enjoyed it. I liked it a lot more than I even remember liking it, but college was a haze for me. So, you know, but that's a whole different story for another episode. And it was, the story moved. The story was very interesting. I like it got more of a backfill of Ace's background, and you also got a lot of, you know, good Dr. Ace interaction and how much the doctor cared for Ace. You could tell in this one. And, you know, how, you know, he had to talk her down from being a cat person, you know, because she was ready to, you know, run off with the other cat person and, you know, go through the wild and everything. And the doctor had to, like, almost like talk her down from the high. Mm-hmm. And it was just interesting to see, and, you know, had to bring back her humanity and how she was doing, you know, everything. And the whole scene with the doctor, Ace, and that little girl, you know, and how they were, Ace was able to see where the cat, the master was at the rec center or whatever, you know, because she had the connection still. And, you know, it would have been interesting to see if she would have kept that power, or like Matthew said in the books, it was a disease and it had to leave her system. Mm. So it would have been interesting to see where they went with that after this, but we'll never know. So, you know, be happy with what we have. And Doctor Who has come back and continuing now for 12 years. You know, we've had
13.
Yep, that's true. 13 doctors for 13 years. How about that? So isn't that convenient? So I think, you know, 3.5 is good for me. And, you know, I can't put it on the same category as last week's as Robots of Death. You know, that was just awesome. This was good, really good, especially for this era, after having, you know, Greatest Show in the Galaxy and, you know, stuff like that, or Candyman and, you know, or Delta and the Bannermen. And okay, I'm not going to go down that path. I'm going to get depressed if I do that. So, you know, let's leave it there. We want to hear from you guys at home. Please write us eswpodcast@gmail.com or call us at 404-963-9057. While we still have Matthew here, hey, Matthew, tell us all about Con K coming up.
Con Castabris, which is the North Alabama Doctor Who convention, will be taking place, our 7th annual event, I should say, will be taking place June 9th and 10th at the Westin at Bridge Street in Huntsville, Alabama, which is just down the road from where I'm recording. Our guests this year will include Mark Shepard, who, of course, is probably best known for Supernatural, but of course was in Doctor Who, playing Canton Everett Delaware III in the Series 6 two-parter The Impossible Astronaut, Day of the Moon. We'll also have Catherine Stewart, who played Jenny, one of the members of the Paternoster Gang. And appropriately enough, because we're talking about survival, Dominic Glynn is going to be one of our guests this year, alongside Kelly Yates, who's worked on the IDW and Titan Doctor Who comics.
That is awesome. How can people find you?
Well, you can go to our website, concasterboris.com. We're also on Facebook, Twitter. I believe we have an Instagram. You could probably just Google Alabama Doctor Who Convention, and we should be the first result, if I'm remembering correctly.
I would hope so. But yeah, it's a great con. We've been going the last few years, and we have had a blast every time we've gone. And, you know, we just enjoy it more and more each year.
Always a good thing to hear, and we hope you guys will be joining us again in June.
I'm planning on it.
Absolutely.
If y'all have us.
Well, we'll have you.
Yay. So I guess we can officially announce that Earth Station Who will be at Con K this year. And what are the dates?
June 9th and 10th.
All right. And Huntsville is a great city. They have a great atmosphere for cons and a lot of geeky people there, since NASA is up there too. So,
indeed.
So very awesome. Let's thank everybody for joining us. Earlier, we had Felicity up here talking about Regeneration Who. Thank her for joining us. And you can find her, of course, as the mayor of Chicken Town on the Flopcast. And let's thank our regulars, Mr. Mike Gordon.
As always, it's my pleasure.
And, of course, Mary Ogle.
Yay. Thank you for having me. And thanks for picking Survival, Matthew. That was a great episode to talk about. And if anyone is looking for my artwork, you can visit me at maryogle.com or on Etsy at eVision Arts.
Hey, you know, that's awesome. Mary has some great artwork up there, and she's actually, you know, has new stuff coming out all the time. And she even has the color. Is the coloring book still up on Amazon?
It is.
You want to plug that real quick?
It is.
Ha ha ha. Ha 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 ha. I gotcha.
You totally got me because it has been so long since I have even thought about the coloring book.
Price one. I got her. All right. Let's cut that part out.
Oh, my God.
But thank you, everyone. Matthew, thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you again for having me.
And everyone, we will be back again in 2 weeks, and we will talk to you then. But until then, be safe. My name is Mike Faber. It's been my pleasure. Peace. And we're done.
Woo!
Woo!
You have been listening to Earth Station Who, a bi-weekly pop culture podcast dedicated to all things Doctor Who, featuring talent from across the universe. All topics on the show are the sole opinions of the individual and are used for entertainment value alone. You can subscribe to our podcast up on iTunes, Stitcher, or follow our blog at www.esopodcast.com. You can also follow us up on Facebook, Twitter, or Google+. If you enjoyed the show, please leave feedback up on iTunes.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping through Amazon.com or the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.